This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Washington Post reporter Steve Faneroo has traveled to Iraq 11 times since the start of the war. And a lot of his reporting there has centered on private security contractors, men and women who work for companies like Blackwater USA, Triple Canopy, and the Crescent Security Group. Modern mercenaries, he calls them, soldiers for hire. Last year, Steve Faneroo won a Pulitzer Prize for this reporting. It's the subject of his new book called Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. Steve Faneroo will join us in just a moment to talk about the role contractors play in Iraq. We also want to hear from you, though. If you or your family member has worked in Iraq as a security contractor, please share your story. Our number here in Washington is 1-800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation at the website as well. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. And later in today's program, we want to know stories of life during the Great Depression. Did you live through that era? Maybe one of your grandparents did. You can send us an email now. The address again is talk@npr.org. Steve Faneroo joins us now from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks so much.
I want to start with the title of the book. It is provocative, Big Boy Rules. What does that mean?
Well, it essentially means that there are no rules for private security contractors in Iraq. I first heard it when I was doing a story about a guy who had told his colleagues that before going out on a mission that he'd really like to kill someone that day. And his colleagues sort of thought about it as kind of an offhanded remark. But when they got out into Baghdad and they were driving down the airport road, he, according to the three other men in the vehicle, he opened up his door and then fired several rounds from his weapon into the windshield of a passing civilian taxi. When they got back to the base, there was an enormous amount of confusion about, on the part of the other three guys, about exactly what they should do. Ultimately, 2 days after the fact, two of the other men who were in the vehicle reported the incident to their supervisors. The company responded by ultimately firing them and firing the guy who had been accused of the shooting. But the thing was, there was no real legal mechanism to deal with this sort of thing. The U.S. occupation government had granted legal immunity from the Iraqi legal process to private security contractors and all contractors, for that matter. And there was just an enormous amount of confusion about sort of what law, if any, applied to these guys. And when I conducted interviews for the story, people told me that they had an expression called big boy rules, which was essentially that they operated under their own system of justice.
So there is no formal authority for these contractors?
It still remains unclear. In 2004, L. Paul Bremer, the head of the occupation government, signed into law an edict basically granting immunity from the Iraqi legal justice system to contractors. And, you know, there have been different views on sort of what exactly law might be applied to their actions. But, you know, as of the end of last year, you know, the U.S. military, which, of course, has its own very sophisticated criminal justice system, you know, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the military had prosecuted some four dozen people in cases of murder in Iraq. Not a single private security contractor had been charged with a crime.
Aside from the obvious, can you just spell out a couple of differences between someone who's a soldier and someone who's a contractor?
Right. Well, I think the primary difference is that the contractors, many of them, I would say the great majority of them, have been in the military and they've acquired skills that are useful in this world in the military. And their primary motivation is money. They've come back to the war because there's just an incredible amount of money to be made in this business. You know, the second difference is that in some cases the jobs are different. There are varying uses for this private security services in Iraq. They range from protecting the U.S. ambassador and diplomats, which is handled under the State Department by companies like Blackwater and Triple Canopy and DynCorp, And then there are other companies like Armor Group that protect supply convoys unrelated to the military. And then there are people who just protect military installations, you know, or strategic installations like warehouses and such. I mean, I think one of the things that really struck me when I first started getting into this world, you know, I'd spent a considerable amount of time in Iraq already before I started covering private security contractors. And the thing that really struck me was just the enormity of it. You know, there were literally, you know, tens of thousands of these guys who were employed in Iraq. They worked for, we know now, at least more than 300 companies. And so I think what happened, you know, one thing that's happened is that Blackwater has gained so much notoriety that has become, you know, kind of the Kleenex of private security companies. And it's really sort of, they've come to define the industry, but there's literally hundreds of companies out there.
What is something that a private security contractor could do or some function it could perform that a soldier couldn't, but maybe a soldier or the military would want the soldier to perform if they could within the rules?
I think it's a difficult question because I think there's an incredible amount of overlap between, you know, what the private security contractors are doing and what the military does. The primary reason that they exist is that, you know, from the beginning of the war, the Bush administration simply failed to provide enough boots on the ground, you know, to prosecute, you know, the war and the aftermath, you know, the to deal with the insurgency and the escalating, you know, security environment that was going on. So, you know, what happened was, you know, these companies ended up taking on responsibility for, you know, providing security on, you know, on issues that, you know, that in places that the soldiers might not either be available or missions that the military simply would not take on. I mean, you know, there are private security contractors of varying stripes all over Iraq. The Washington Post, my newspaper, we had our own security team to move around, you know, in Baghdad and around Iraq. Non-governmental organizations like the International Republican Institute, which is chaired by John McCain, you know, and the National Democratic Institute, which is chaired by Madeleine Albright, they use these guys to move around Baghdad to, you know, to promote democracy. I mean, it's simply a function of the war. You needed to get around Iraq. You needed security. So I think the question of sort of what private security contractors do and what the military doesn't do, it's really vague. It's hard to sort of differentiate. And of course, the insurgents never differentiated. They'd fire on all of them.
Who are the young men and women who join these contracting firms? You mentioned briefly that a lot of them had military experience previously, but is there a profile or a personality type?
You know, one of the more interesting things that I found when, you know, I started to do this reporting was really how incredibly diverse this universe of people was. You know, the main profile was that they were all people who were looking for a big paycheck in Iraq. I mean, everybody was, you know, everybody, their primary reason for, you know, for doing this work was the money. But then when you got beyond that, there were all kinds of diverse reasons that, you know, that sort of played into it. You know, I think all of them, if there's a type, it's like they're all, you know, adrenaline junkies. They're addicted to the action, and maybe many of them became addicted to the action while they were in the military. You know, the main character in my book is a guy named John Cote, who had been a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne. He did tours in Afghanistan, combat tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. And when he came out, of the military, he enrolled at the University of Florida.
And he was a lot older, right, than a lot of the students as well at that point.
He was 22 at that point. And, you know, it should have been a utopian environment for John. I mean, he's an incredibly good-looking kid, very charismatic, you know, intelligent, sensitive, you know, caring. People just, men and women, just sort of flocked around him. He had a million friends. But what he found was that he just could not cope with civilian life. You know, he felt like the world in which he was sort of indulging was, you know, incredibly superficial. And, you know, after running out of money and, you know, binge drinking for quite some time, and then driving his motorcycle too fast and finally getting a drunk driving arrest, you know, a friend of his from the military offered him a job, you know, making $7,000 a month protecting supply convoys in Iraq. And so he jumped at the opportunity. And I think, you know, I think there are a lot of people like that who come back from Iraq. You know, I think Iraq, for many people, including myself, who's, you know, who have been there, it has this strangely, the intensity of it, I think, has a strangely addictive quality. And, you know, John, I think it's fairly certain, I think everyone would agree, was suffering from post-traumatic stress. Mm. And, you know, I think that sort, there's a sort of perverse idea there where someone who felt, who was dealing with the lingering effects of combat comes back and can't deal with sort of, or is having difficulty dealing with the, you know, the banality of, you know, of daily life, is able to then take a job to go back into Iraq to sort of deal with that problem. I really find that sort of a perverse concept.
And there's also the reality in John's case, for example, sometimes they run out of money. People actually do this simply for the cash. And you've mentioned a couple of times, without being crass, can you tell me how much money really there is to be made?
Of course, yeah. You know, John was making $7,000 a month with the company that he was working for, Crescent Security. I mean, Crescent was sort of at the low end of the security spectrum. You know, they you know, unlike Blackwater, which, you know, has, you know, I think nearly 1,000 people in Iraq now and helicopters and highly sophisticated armored vehicles, you know, Crescent was, you know, sort of the Kmart of private security. And, you know, they were running around Iraq in pickup trucks, you know, barely armored pickup trucks, you know, with a lot less experienced personnel, and they were making $7,000 a month. You know, the companies like Blackwater, Armor Group, Triple Canopy, Aegis, DynCorp, you know, they're all sort of at the high end of the spectrum. And the going rate was for them was, you know, $15,000 to $20,000 a month.
We're speaking with Steve Fanneroo. We'll continue the conversation in just a minute. The book is called Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. We'll get to your calls. If you do want to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-989-8255. You can reach us by email as well. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Allison Stewart. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington, D.C. We're in the middle of a conversation with Steve Fanneroo, a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, who's written a new book called Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq. And we do want to talk to Alex, who's calling in from San Diego. And Alex, I understand you worked as a contractor.
Yes.
And when and where?
I'd rather not be specific, but...
Okay, sure.
Within the last few years...
Okay, can you describe your experience? Was it like what you've been hearing Steve talk about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, everything is, there's a lot of security as far as, there's a lot of protection as far as who you are, who the individual is. And, but it's the necessary, it's a very necessary function.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things that the military can't do. Because of the size of the military, a lot of things that they can't do because of the because of politics, and I think the wave of the future is a lot of these contractors stepping in and filling those voids. They do overlap with military etiquette, and there's just a lot of things that the military can't do, but it needs to be done, and the public really doesn't understand that. World War II wouldn't have been what it was if it was on TV, if it was brought into people's living rooms. There's a lot of covert operations that are carried out on a daily basis that are directly responsible for small and large steps that help the United States and our cause.
Alex from San Diego, thank you very much for calling in. Steve, I want to read a passage from your book. You're writing about John Cote, and I don't think we're giving away anything because people actually may recognize the name. He was kidnapped, and he was killed. And this is at the end of your book. You wrote, "I liked John Côté the moment I met him, and I fell in love with his family. But it was an ugly business he'd gotten himself into, perhaps the ugliest business there was. The U.S. government had fostered it as a manifestation of our failures in Iraq, a method for shifting responsibility and hiding the human toll, the stain of original sin. Private security contracting, what a name for it, but it fit the times." How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I've always felt that, private security contracting, it really hid the cost of the war. You know, all the basic metrics that the military and our government uses to measure how the war was going in Iraq were essentially rendered meaningless, I thought, because, you know, you never knew exactly how many troops there were because the private security contractors weren't counted. You know, you never knew exactly how many casualties there were because they weren't counted. You know, you never knew how many people they were killing or how many times they were firing, how many engagements they had, because none of it was counted. It was almost as if the government really didn't want to acknowledge that they existed. And so when John Côté, you know, who had been a decorated U.S. Army veteran, you know, was killed in Iraq, I mean, he didn't even merit a statistic. I mean, he was not counted among the casualty figures. And I just felt like, you know, I felt like it really captured in many ways the ambiguity of this war, and that, you know, the United States government, I think, from the beginning of the war, I think honestly has been, you know, somewhat disingenuous about the scope of the war and, you know, and why it was being fought. And I felt like in a way that for me, you know, after spending 3 years in Iraq, that John Côté, you know, his life and his death in many ways became symbolic for me about sort of what the war was about.
There's two exchanges between a young public policy student and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, and that same student and the president. She asked the question about what laws govern contractors. Can you describe their replies?
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting thing because her husband is in the military, and he had had an encounter with Blackwater in Baghdad where he was driving in a civilian vehicle, and the Blackwater team bullied its way into a traffic circle and was running civilians onto the sidewalk and then popped off a few rounds. And, you know, he was enraged by this about sort of what it meant, and he told his wife who was going to school at Georgetown. And so she, when Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, you know, came to speak at the school, she asked him what laws apply to their actions, you know, and he kind of stammered and stuttered. And, you know, the reality is, I don't think he really knew, because ultimately he said, well, you know, Iraq is a sovereign country and, you know, it's their country. But it was clear that he didn't know. So, you know, she didn't give up. You know, coincidentally, President Bush came to speak at Georgetown a few months later, and she followed up with a question to him, and the president's response was literally help. You know, he had no idea, and he said, I'm going to ask my Secretary of Defense, and, you know, and see if we can straighten this out. But, you know, it was never entirely clear. And I think, you know, frankly, when I started reporting this, and I'd go to the military to ask questions, you know, really basic questions about how the companies were regulated, you know, and you know, what exactly they were doing to, you know, to regulate them, the replies that I got, they inevitably really, really did not know the answers to them.
If you or a family member has worked in Iraq as a security contractor, we'd love for you to join this conversation. Our number here in Washington is 1-800-989-8255. If you feel more comfortable via email, please do that, talk@npr.org. We're going to talk to Max. Max is calling us from Rock Springs, Wyoming. And Max, I understand you're a vet.
I am, and I got two brothers that are vets also. They're both in the Marine Corps, or we're in the Marine Corps. Once Marine, always Marine. But I know a lot of us were just insulted working alongside these guys at how much money our government was paying to them. And we all knew what we were getting, and it wasn't anything close to the thousands of dollars. And a lot of us, even though we'd work with these guys, really felt like maybe our government ought to put that money back into the military itself for recruitment and retention and training.
Max, thanks for calling. Steve, did you ever hear that from other soldiers?
Yeah, you'd hear it all the time. You know, the Marines and the soldiers who were over there, you know, I think they responded to these guys with a mixture of emotions, sort of ranging from, you know, resentment to curiosity to awe about the enormous amounts of money that they were making. You know, I think one of the biggest problems, because there was this sort of disconnect between the military and the, you know, and these mercenary guys, I think a lot of the resentment was fueled because of in situations where the private security teams would get involved in engagements and would stir up emotions in local populations that fell within the areas of operation of the military, and then the military would have to go in and clean up the mess. You know, I mean, of course, the most dramatic example of this is when Blackwater, you know, ended up killing 17 Iraqis at a traffic circle in Baghdad last September. And, you know, it was in the middle of the surge when General Petraeus had adjusted the U.S. military strategy in Iraq. And, you know, it really complicated the relationship between the Iraqi government and the American government, you know, for quite some time.
Want to talk to Sean in California, who has also served in the armed services. Hi, Sean.
Yes, thank you. I'm glad you're speaking about this topic. My unit served on the Iraqi oil platforms in the northern Persian Gulf. And oftentimes, we'd have to fly back or boat back to Doha in Kuwait to draw supplies. Well, that base is another base where these private security contractors, run the traffic and do the gate guard duties formerly that you'd expect the military to do. Well, I was a driver for my unit's chief, and we got pulled over on this base by one of these private contractors, and my chief was pretty irate because, you know, by whose authority? Because if the base general gives a PFC the authority to do that, it's understood. The UCMJ protects him all the way back up to the Joint Chiefs. My chief was of the opinion, like, you don't have the authority to pull me over. You're not in uniform. You're not governor of the UCMJ. And he tried to make a case and, you know, take it up the chain a bit. But it's a rather benign example of the interface between, you know, the military and the private contractors. And one last comment, I'll take all my comments off the air. The private contractors over there, like the military, that they're getting large sums of money. Yes, and people need to keep in mind that money is tax-free. So that it's a substantial amount of money. Thank you. I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Sean, thanks for sharing your stories. You know, as I was reading your book, Steve, it's sort of the chicken and the egg question came to me. The behaviors, which some of them seem really radical, you know, did the behaviors come first and the people who decide to become contractors change because of behaviors, or were they sort of renegades in the first place and they just have found the right place for themselves inside of these contracting firms?
Right. Well, I think one thing that we should say is that, you know, the great majority of the people who are working in contracting over there, you know, they're not cowboys, they're not renegades, they're respecting the rule of law.
Thanks for making that point.
You know, so I don't think we should just, you know, kind of lump all these guys into this sort of one thing. But, you know, I do think they're, you know, like we were talking about before, you know, there is a type. These people are type A personalities. They're coming into a war zone. I think the problem is that there was absolutely zero regulation coming out of the United States government, you know, especially the State Department. And so, you know, for example, with Blackwater, long before they, you know, they ended up killing 17 people in this traffic circle last September, you know, they had been engaged in a pattern of activity in which they were engaging and shooting, getting involved in shootings of civilians. And when it came time to investigate those, you know, those incidents, the State Department simply deferred to Blackwater's version of events. There was no real check on their behavior, not to mention that there was no real law. And so I think my feeling is that it escalated from there, that, you know, the Blackwater problem was something that was, you know, that was brewing for, you know, for years, really. And, you know, it was an open secret in Baghdad. I mean, you'd hear it all the time. I mean, not only from Iraqis, you know, who despised them, but, you know, a lot of Americans too. You know, another security contractor told me that they were, you know, Blackwater was widely despised within the green zone because of their behavior. You know, they often pointed their weapons at civilians. You know, they ran people off the road in the middle of the green zone. You know, they were sort of a force unto themselves, and I think a lot of people resented that. But the State Department simply did not get involved.
Let's check in with Samantha calling us from Boise, Idaho. Hi, Samantha.
Hello.
So you know someone who was involved with contracting?
I do. He's an ex-Marine, and he actually was in the first Gulf War. He ended up going over to Iraq a few times, and one time was working for a contractor that put him into an hostile area unarmed, and he questioned that. He felt that his safety was in question, and because of that, he was shipped out of Iraq within a couple days.
Samantha, thanks for sharing your story. Does that sound familiar to you, Steve?
It does. You know, there are companies that are that will, you know, when there is misbehavior, they'll respond. The issue really is for me that it's a company by company situation. Mm-hmm. You know, Armour Group, for example, a British company that ran supply convoys, they were incredibly aggressive about making sure that everybody played by the rules. You know, they made sure that they were licensed. They made sure that their weapons permits were in order. If anybody broke the rules, they disciplined them immediately. But of course, that was a decision that the company made. So you had hundreds of companies that were, you know, that were out there operating, basically all of them setting their own rules under literally thousands of different contracts. And so, it's really not uniform.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're speaking with Steve Faneroo about his book, Big Boy Rules. It's about private security contractors in Iraq. I do want to take one more call. Hi, John. You're calling from Forked River, New Jersey?
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Hi. I'm doing well. I understand you lost a friend.
Friend of mine that I went over. I was a fire contractor in Iraq from 2004 to 2007. And someone that I worked with over there was convinced by a contract company to go ahead and leave our job and go to work for them, which, due to the increased money and everything else, he thought it was a great idea. Well, he actually walked off the job, went to work for them, but shortly after, he was killed. I don't remember if it was an IED or they got caught in a gun battle or whatever, but he got killed. And my comment is to the money that the contract companies, the security contractors, are taking in and what they're spending to protect their employees. A lot of the vehicles I saw them driving around in were basically, pickup trucks with armor plating welded on or bolted on. Some would have Suburbans, and a guy would be a rear shooter sitting in the back of the vehicle with the window up or window gone with just some sheet metal, welded up there to try to protect them. Now other security contractors went the extra effort, and they bought some of these South African, blast-resistant vehicles with the V-shaped hulls, which were really nice and had great seating inside, but many others did not. They spent very little money on protecting their contractors.
John, thank you so much for sharing your story about you and your friend. Steve, you write so much. You write quite a bit about some of the issues that John just mentioned. You talk about the money. You talk about kidnappings. You're very graphic in some parts of the book. You talk about your own personal story. You lost your father during the course of this. Have you heard from any of the contracting firms since you've written the book?
I've heard from Crescent, the company that I write most about, and of course the president of the company is not happy about some of the stuff that we've detailed in the Washington Post and now in the book. I've also heard from the families of the Crescent hostages who were ultimately killed, and I think that their feeling is that they're glad that that some of this information is out there, so people will know the conditions under which they were working. I mean, the last caller, his comments are dead on. It just was not uniform. When I saw Crescent, after hanging out with the military, I was shocked. I mean, they were driving into Iraq at a time when everyone was using up-armored vehicles, to protect themselves. They're driving into Iraq, as the caller said, with pickup trucks. The first person I met was the so-called medic of the company. He had no real medical background. He was a self-described alcoholic.
I have to tell you, though, some of the details in your book are really, it's extraordinary, and I encourage people to read it. We're out of time, unfortunately, Steve. Steve Faneroo, author of Big Boy Rules. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, you hear the economy's the worst it's been since the Great Depression. What does that mean? Lillian Howell was 10 in 1929. Her father lost the job. The family packed up and headed to live with relatives in Virginia.
We sold what household things we had, which was very few. But we took the one prized possession that my mother had, an ivory dresser set. And it was a three-day trip in that Model T Ford that Dad purchased with all the money he could get together. Somewhere along the way, we were out of money. We found this grocery store. So Dad remembered that dresser set. And he said, there's nothing to do but to pawn it. We've got to have the money. We've got to have food. We've got to have gas. And my mother, she reluctantly gave up her prize.
We want to hear your stories of life during the Depression. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now, remember the good old days when we chewed over whether or not we were in a recession? Now that hard times are getting harder, it's the word depression that people are sort of bandying about. When we say depression, many of us think we know what it looks like, but there are plenty of people who actually remember, and that's who we want to hear from today. Do you have a memory of the Great Depression? What was it like, and what did you learn? Our number here in Washington is 1-800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. In the studio today is independent producer Nina Ellis. She's been collecting stories about the Depression for a feature that will run on All Things Considered on Thanksgiving Day, like the story from Les O'Rear. He worked in the stockyards on the south side of Chicago in the days when paid vacation didn't exist.
You had Thanksgiving off. The company was kind enough to give you the day off. But you didn't get any pay. You didn't get any vacation. You didn't get any benefits of that sort. It's hard now for anybody, I guess, to remember that that's the way the world worked in those days before unions. That is the difference, kiddos.
Okay, kiddos. Les O'Rear is only one of the stories Nana Ellis collected. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So who did you talk to get these stories?
I went all over the city. You know, Chicago is a city of neighborhoods. I happened to be born on the South Side, so a lot of the people that I met were from neighborhoods that I knew about. But I also tried to find people in neighborhoods I had never been to or would not have naturally gone to as a young child. People experienced the Depression in different ways in different parts of the city. But the first person I want you to meet is a lady named Wanda Bridgeforth. She's 87 years old. She's from a neighborhood on the south side known as Bronzeville. It was a very famous black neighborhood. Chicago was much more segregated then than it is now, and unemployment in the black neighborhood sometimes reached as high as 40%. Let's hear Wanda.
To be without a job in the days when it took two incomes to make a family work, you had a sense of uselessness. Here was my father with a degree in chemistry, and he could not get a job. When he did get a job, it was as a stockman. The man who was the manager of the store had a high school education, and he would come to my father for my father to fill out the reports and to make the orders, and to work up the payroll, and that kind of thing.
Was that humiliating for your father?
It definitely was. It definitely was. And it worked on him. Sometimes I would see him just grit his teeth.
A lot of men were without jobs during the Depression. The unemployment was very high, and it was hard on families. Wanda was boarded out as a child. Mm. Her mother had to go to work full-time and couldn't and lived in as a domestic. So Wanda lived with other families, sometimes even with strangers, because her parents couldn't afford to keep her at home.
I can imagine some of these stories must have been very emotional and difficult for people to speak to.
Very emotional.
Did you have a hard time, but was it difficult for people to share?
Sometimes it was, I think. You know, they're bad memories for people. A lot of us, I grew up hearing stories about the Depression that, you know, my parents were, it made it sound like great fun. You know, oh, remember the guy that used to bring the ice and we used to play kickball in the alley, and I heard those kind of stories. But I didn't hear the really, you know, gritty, hard stories about poverty. I want to play for you a little tape from a fellow named Henry Martinez. He lived in South Chicago, which is down near Lake Michigan, where there were a lot of steel mills. His father was a Mexican immigrant, and there were 13 kids in his family. They had a very rough time.
Can you imagine the panic of having 13 children?
Yep.
After the stock market crash and the Great Depression.
Imagine it. So let's hear Henry Martinez now.
It was always a challenge to keep warm. We hugged each other on the floor. We had little beds that open and close. When I think about it, it was horrible. It was horrible. And then the sanitation of the community, garbage was just put in the alley, and did that create a condition? Yes, it did. TB. I know my sister came down with TB. Sometimes I like to block that out, just so you know. Thank God you're here.
Some of these people, you know, they don't tell their kids the really sad parts. You know, that's what I found interesting. You know, if you sit with somebody long enough, though, and keep probing and probing, as I tried to do, these things come out in the end. I want to play you a little more happy story.
Sure.
And there were a lot of those, because people have good memories, because they were working together. They were sharing. You hear story after story about how everybody was in the same boat and they had to share. And as young children, they really didn't know that they were having hard times because they knew nothing else. This is a wonderful lady named Gigi Cortese. She lives in Bridgeport, the same neighborhood she grew up in. I met with her and a group of her friends. She had known them all since she was in elementary school. None of them had left the neighborhood. That happens a lot in Chicago. Gigi's parents were Croatian immigrants, and her father made wine in the basement, and her mother did laundry and took in boarders to make ends meet. They also had a lot of kids. Gigi and her friends told me, though, a lot of stories about good times that they had. And here's a little bit of Gigi Cortese.
And we had a man that lived upstairs. We called him John Vuk. And every Sunday he took us to the show. You know how I survived those days was going to the show every Sunday to see Shirley Temple.
Shirley Temple on the Good Ship Lollipop. Lots of people talked about Shirley Temple.
It's very interesting when you describe what people were doing to get by and listening to various reports on television of people saying, oh, don't buy an extra toy for Christmas. People were taking boarders into their homes.
Boarders into their homes, yes.
I mean, the kind of, we're talking about just trying to struggle through this Christmas season when you really think about what people had to do for years to survive and
That's
to make
right.
sure their families were safe.
People needed to go to the Salvation Army played a big role. The Catholic Church played a big role. Lots of people told me stories about not having shoes to get through the winter, having to put cardboard on the inside of the soles of their shoes. And one fellow told me a story and started crying telling the story about having to wear galoshes over his shoes because he had so many holes in his shoes and the other kids making fun of him. People, we think we sacrifice now, but it was a much more dire situation back then.
Let's talk to some of our listeners. Esther is calling us from Chesterland, Ohio. Hi, Esther.
Hi.
How are you? You have a story about your brother?
It's the story of the lost quarter.
Oh, I like to hear this.
Well, with a quarter, you could get a pound of hamburger and a loaf of bread and a pound of coffee. And that was to be our supper. And the mother gave us a quarter. And we ran to the store, and my brother had the quarter in his hand, and he was throwing it up in the air and catching it, and he missed.
Oh,
and
no.
Went down into the gutter through the grate, the sewer grate. And we tried everything we could to get that quarter back. That was our supper. And we couldn't get it. And all winter long, all of the kids at the school and we would pass by that grate and try with sticks and nails on the ends of boards and everything, trying to get that quarter, and we never did get it.
Well, I'm impressed that you didn't give up. Esther, thanks for sharing your memory with us.
Thanks for listening. My grandchildren would say, she got it told.
Sound like you have great grandchildren. Thanks, Esther.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Roger in St. Louis. Hi, Roger.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. So what did your grandfather do?
Well, my grandfather was a Pullman porter, which was a very special job for African Americans during that time. And as you know, it was segregation. And while he was on the train stopped, and he leaned out to look to see why they would stop. And a white man and his two small children approached the train. And my grandfather said what was unusual was the man said, called him sir. And he said, sir, do you have any food? And Pullman porters would typically work a 20-hour day, and they might get one meal. And he gave his meal to the man. And that's a story that's been passed on in our family about my grandfather's depression.
What a great story of kindness. Thanks for sharing it, Roger.
Thank you.
You touched on that a little bit, Nina, how people did pull together and did try to help as much as they could.
And shared. You know, it's very commonly I heard stories about a stranger would knock at the door, usually the back door, and somebody would ask for food. And nobody can remember ever turning anybody away. They would bring the person in, give them food. One lady, Wanda Bridgeforth, who we heard from before, said her sister met somebody on the street and begged her mother to bring that person home and give them a bed, and they did, a stranger. So that kind of thing happened. I heard stories about that over and over and over again.
And we'd love to hear your stories, your memories of the Great Depression. What was it like? What did you learn? What do you think about then as compared to now? Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. And this is an email from Renee from Mission, Kansas. She writes, my grandma grew up during the Depression in rural South Dakota, and one of the family heirlooms I received from her is a crocheted lace bedspread. When she gave it to me, she said, I started this bedspread when I was in high school. First, we had a depression, and we couldn't afford the cotton. Then we had a war, and we couldn't get the cotton. Then I had babies, and I didn't have time to crochet. And I didn't get it finished until your dad and your brother were both in school. What a great story. Renee, yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. Let's talk to John in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hello, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to relay the story. When I first learned about the Depression as a child, my great aunt had lived through it, and our family was at her house for a Labor Day picnic. When the picnic was done, she went through and rinsed off all the paper plates and put them in the cupboard, and I was curious about it. My parents explained that she grew up in the Depression, and she learned how to just get by with whatever she could.
All right, John from Michigan, thanks so much.
Thanks.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're speaking with independent producer Nina Ellis, who is working on collecting stories about the Depression. This is going to air on All Things Considered?
On Thanksgiving Day.
Yes.
You know, we thought it would be a good time because families would be together. Presumably, there'd be an opportunity for the senior members of a family to tell their stories. And I think maybe now people might be a little more interested in listening.
Isn't it interesting that of the calls we've had two from younger generation who the story has stuck with them about what their grandparent went through or great aunt in that case?
Yeah, it is. It's a good thing.
Let's talk to Doris in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Doris.
Hi.
Hi, Doris. So tell me a little bit about, do you mind if I tell people how old you are?
Yeah, I'm 82.
Oh, you did it for me. Okay. Oh,
yes, I'm 82, and I can remember well because we had to keep, we were moving all the time to find a different job. And my dad was such a hard worker, and he tried so much. And this one time when we had to go back and stay with my grandparents for a couple of years while he found another job in Michigan, he cried. My mom said, I never saw him cry, but he just, you know, he was trying so hard. And then the thing they told me to tell you about, well, we had very few clothing. I mean, I had two dresses, I can remember, and when I was at school, some of the children teased me. There was one girl, Joyce, I still remember her name. She used to say, well, my father's a dentist, and he makes $200 a month or something. You know, and my father made so little, and my dad would go out fishing and hunting and work on farms and do what he could. And then he did have a job, and then that job closed, and he had to move again. So that's how it was. But we always had a good place to live, but when we left Michigan, we hadn't paid the rent for several months. We couldn't do it. I mean, it was things like that. And then we came back into Ohio. We'd been up in Michigan. We came back to Ohio. And then finally, when the war started, then we started to have, we had jobs.
Yeah. Doris, may I ask you a question?
Pardon?
May I ask you a question?
Sure.
As someone who lived through this and has very vivid memories, You know, we're going through difficult economic times now. Do you see any similarities at all?
Well, I hope not. Not yet, but there surely can be because, well, we still, now for my age, I have my Social Security and pension, and I don't, so many people, I'm just hoping they can keep their jobs. I'm concerned so much about my grandchildren because in so many jobs, you're going to be losing your job, and that's going to be really, really difficult because people are living so high, for one thing, now. I mean, you know, they've got, they expect to have two cars and house and all those things, and then it comes to a point where you don't have the money, and that's going to be really terrible. I grew up sort of being used to not having it for a long time. So when we finally had it, I mean, well, we appreciated it very much, and I'm the same way. I don't rinse off plates or anything
anymore.
But I don't like to waste. I don't like to waste.
That's an excellent lesson. Thank you so much, Doris. Hi, Helen from Ohio.
Yes, hello.
How are you?
Who did you say?
I want to hear about the story about losing your car, Helen.
Oh, yeah, Helen.
Yes, I want to hear your
story. From Helen.
Yeah, I want to hear
Well, it was quite a blow to our pride because we weren't getting enough money. His shop my father worked in had just about gone broke but hadn't, and he was the only person part of the time working in this factory at that time. And out of it, we tried to eat and live. And we didn't have enough money to, pay the bills. Hello.
Yep. Helen, we appreciate you taking time to tell us that story. I want to tell everybody, Helen's 93 years old and shared her stories, had some clear memories of what went happened. What do you think lessons people can learn? And we have about a minute left, Nina. From listening to these stories of the Depression,
what stays with me is how people talk about how they shared with one another and took care of each other. Everybody emphasized that, and a fellow that I interviewed also said, you know, when you have money, you're not always paying as close attention to other people. He said, back then people took care of each other, and that's my best memory of the Depression.
Independent producer Nina Ellis, you can hear her series about life during the Depression. It's going to be on All Things Considered on Thanksgiving Day. Thank you so much for coming
you,
and
Allison.
Sharing your tape. Good luck putting everything together.
Thanks.
I'm Allison Stewart. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Neil Conan will be back on Monday.